The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Central Nervous System Infections is presented by Dr. Marc-Alain Durie.
We're going to talk about CNS infections right now. At the end of this presentation, hopefully you guys will be familiar with some of the major causes of community-acquired bacterial meningitis. And of course, I could tell you what they are. It's pneumococcus and the meninge. We'll also talk a bit about the diagnosis of aseptic meningitis. And the point here is to kind of really help you understand, not only clinically, but also on an exam, how to tell the two apart, because they are two very different diseases, and they're fairly simple to kind of diagnose one from the other. So what I'm talking about there is bacterial meningitis versus aseptic meningitis. And then we'll wrap up this portion of the lecture talking about epidural abscesses. So the long list there. The ones that I would really recommend you really know are the top two, of course, pneumococcus and meninge. I think I've only seen one listeria meningitis, maybe two, and these were in significantly immunocompromised individuals. And as you could see there in a CDC study there, meninge and pneumococcus were responsible for about 80% of adult cases for meningitis. There's vaccines that have been very helpful that have been driving down the Haemophilus influenza meningitis. So we're not seeing as much of that, fortunately, anymore. And again, listeria. So I've only seen one or two of them in my total career. So it's early bacterial meningitis. It's difficult to recognize. The symptoms can be nonspecific. You're, of course, going to see your signs of rash, fever, mental status changes, and headaches. The classic triad that we hear about, fever, neck stiffness, and altered mental status, is not found in very many folks, 44% here. But at least two of the four following symptoms are found as headache, fever, neck stiffness, and altered mental status. What I typically see is headache and fever. That's most common. What we see in other symptoms can include photophobia, nausea, vomiting, irritable states. Some focal neurologic findings can also be found. In terms of clinical pneumococcal and meninge infections are those that cause the petechia, the purpura. If somebody does have petechia or purpura, that's typically meninge. These people are very, very, very sick and oftentimes are in the ICU. Koenigs and Brudinskis, to be honest with you, I rarely ever look for them. I think it's one of these things that are more likely to be on the exam than you to see clinically. You can see here that it's present in less than 5%, but it's one of those classic medical things that we just are aware of. Jerry brought up a very good point, and that is, I think it's worth understanding the LP, the lumbar puncture result table, the one that he did. And the values, not necessarily understanding the values, but it's very relevant because it is, there's a lot of information that can be ascertained from it. So I'm going to try to explain it in a way that at least makes sense to me. Anything that has an opening pressure that's high, any opening pressure that's high, you have to think about cryptococcal meningitis in somebody with AIDS. All right, so that's an easy test question. Usually those 30, 35, the times that I've done LPs, literally the minute I put the needle in, there's so much pressure, sometimes you've had to kind of get out of the way because there was that rapid, the pressure just kind of pushed the CSF out of the needle. When you think about a bacterial meningitis, you're thinking about a very acute inflammatory response. When you're thinking the aseptic meningitis, you're thinking about a far less inflammatory response. So you're going to see that on your LP, right? So when you're thinking of a bacterial meningitis, big inflammatory response, you're going to see a big white count. You're going to see a big protein. The protein is basically the inflammatory system going in and responding. So you're seeing antibodies. So you're going to see high protein. And then you're going to see low glucose because you have so much organism there that's literally feeding off of that glucose. So in a big inflammatory response, you're seeing high white count, high protein, because that's the response of the immune system, and low glucose. In aseptic meningitis, you're seeing that much more tight. It's, so you have a far less inflammatory response because the virus doesn't cause such a big inflammatory response. The bacteria does. So you're seeing a much lower response from the immune system. So your white count is lower. Your protein is going to still be elevated, but it's going to be a lot lower elevated. And then your glucose is oftentimes normal. And that's an easy way to kind of think of through that table. And like Jerry said, I think it's worth understanding. So here, in terms of diagnosis, of course, do an LP. One of my mentors was Rodrigo Hasbun. Rodrigo Hasbun, as a fellow, he did a 5-year ID fellowship, and he did two very important papers in the ID world. One of them was that seminal paper in early 2000s that actually removed the idea of doing a CT scan before doing the LP unless there's focal neurologic findings. And so oftentimes the most important thing to do is obviously go directly to antibiotics, but we'll get to that in a second. First thing you should do is an LP if and when possible. And again, those are some of the CSF results that you're going to see. And again, in a bacterial meningitis, you're seeing these very, very high numbers reflective of a very, very responsive immune system. Here's another thing that I would ask you guys to know. The most common organisms are pneumococcus and the meninge, right, Neisseria. Have you ever asked yourself why vancomycin and ceftriaxone are considered the drugs of choice? If you haven't, you should. And if I were writing a test question, I would write a question that would force you to understand why vancomycin is used. Staph aureus is not on that list. You have not seen Staph aureus on that list. Why is vancomycin the drug of choice? The reason why it's the drug of choice is that pneumococcus has an endogenous 10% resistance to cephalosporins. So that vancomycin is there covering the covering the pneumococcus, that 10%, that one out of every 10 time that pneumococcus is going to be resistant to ceftriaxone, that vancomycin is covering that. And that's something you should know. As doctors, you guys need to be aware of that. The other thing to consider as well that is incredibly important, and again, when you look at dairy's rules for the boards to do things that save lives, dexamethasone is something that you need to be aware of. So steroids in the setting of a pneumococcal meningitis is incredibly important. Studies are very, very clear that they save lives. So I would probably set up a question that forces you to acknowledge that the dexamethasone or some steroids are needed. In terms of DCing the steroids, I wouldn't ask that they do that. I would definitely, of course, have an ID doctor on board in the real clinical setting that can help you kind of figure that out in terms of when to discontinue. The thing with steroids is that it works. Studies have only shown it working with pneumococcus. It's not been shown to work with the meninge. Of course, there's chemoprophylaxis. I doubt they would ask you about it, but you should just be aware that Cipro and rifampin are necessary for that. And these are only for close contacts, right? Only for close contacts. Somebody who was in the ambulance, somebody who intubated, that sort of stuff. And of course, the encapsulated organisms, Haemophilus, Neisseria, and pneumococcus all have their own vaccines. And of course, we support the utilization of those vaccines. Aseptic meningitis is a different story. It's far, far, far more common, right? You see far more common likely to see aseptic meningitis with the enterovirus, Coxsackie, and HSV being the most likely organisms, certainly in my personal experience as well. We're going to put a pin in HSV because if I were writing test questions, I would ask that you guys know about HSV. Because, again, HSV is something you can test for and then do something about. So I would write a question forcing you to acknowledge that we can test for HSV and then we can do something about it. So we'll put a pin in HSV, and you'll see me kind of thread through the rest of this section of the lecture. So, of course, this is a very common presentation, lots of hospitalizations. Again, you see the fever, headache. The headache, to me, I've seen in aseptic meningitis tends to be far more intense, acute pain. With aseptic meningitis, with bacterial meningitis, it's much more just global. That's just something that I've seen. Photophobia, nausea, vomiting, rash. Of course, you're going to see possibly some diarrhea and GI issues associated with aseptic meningitis because of the organisms and the etiology there. I have seen NSAIDs-induced meningitis, so I would just be aware that it's out there as well. Physical exam, again, you're going to see the meningismus, the cranial nerve palsies, rash. And then other sources, you know, you may see etiologies such as hand, foot, mouth. That may provide a clue as to what the source of the aseptic meningitis is. Of course, acute flaccid paralysis is suggestive of West Nile. The labs, like we said before, in understanding that table, and again, it's very worth understanding that the CSF results. You're seeing a far less inflammatory response than when you do with the bacterial. And that's, again, I can't urge you more than that to try to kind of wrap your head around that and understand that. With HSV, you see a triad. And this is the triad that I would ask you to know, is that you'll see temporal lobe abnormalities, you'll see some blood in the CSF, and you'll see you'll see mental status changes. Sorry, I was inside my head. So you'll see, so let me do that again. Temporal lobe abnormality, CSF, you'll see blood, if even a couple drops, but you will see some red blood cells. It'll say 3 red blood cells. It's not because of the actual needle being inserted. It's as a result of the HSV. And then the third is mental status changes, right? And what'll happen is I've seen hyper, like, sexualization. I've seen people go on spending sprees, like online spending sprees. And so you have to dig for that. So don't miss those clues. On CT scan, they'll say something about some temporal lobe changes, and then you'll go back to the CSF, and you go, oh, yeah, there was a couple of RBCs in that CSF. And then when you go and ask the family, has the patient changed? Or, oh, yeah, there's been some odd behaviors recently. So just something to think about, and I would strongly consider knowing that as well. The diagnosis studies, there we are, enterovirus and HSF, CSF, PCR. And that's super important. And that's why I would ask you guys to know HSV, because when you know that you have aseptic meningitis, right, the white count is super low or patient doesn't look like a bacterial meningitis, you can always send out for the HSV via PCR. I would encourage you to do that. And then I would encourage you to start acyclovir as well, 10 milligrams per kilogram, Q8 hours, okay? And then you stop the acyclovir when that HSV PCR comes back negative, okay? And then obviously continue if it's positive, all right? So if I were to write a test question, I would write a test question that would look along the lines of you understanding that you would test for an HSV, I would put that triad in there, that you would look for HSV and then you would treat for it. That is, without question, the thing that I've seen the most in my career, especially when it comes to CNS changes and infections. In terms of treatment, of course, supportive care for most. Obviously, there's no antivirals to be used, of course, with the exception, of course, in HSV. There used to be a disease process called Mollaret's meningitis that it's not referred to as Mollaret's anymore. It's not just called recurrent HSV too, but that's just something, I've only seen it once in my career, and it was a long, long, long time ago. I've not seen it since, but I would just be aware that there's this thing that people can get, which is recurrent HSV meningitis. So in terms of epidural abscess, Staph aureus, and it's almost exclusively, in my experience, related to IV drug users. So just something to be thinking about. And the take home, the short take home here is back pain in an IV drug user and fevers, you really need to be thinking about epidural abscess, and you need to start vancomycin right away. But those are some of the other organisms that cause it as well. And of course, after a post-neurosurgical procedure, you should be considering that as well. Of course, about 2012, 2013, God, that was a while ago. In fact, I think, Jerry, we even talked about it, didn't we? The outbreak that happened with the, it had the aspergillus in the steroid injections. That was a compounding pharmacy in New England, I think. And that's something just to be aware of, that existed. That was something that was there, and that caused the epidural abscess as well. And I think Jerry and I reported about it in one of the ACOI conferences as it was happening. Any immunocompetent host, immunocompromised hosts as well, and then in foreign-born individuals, you can get disseminated TB in the form of an epidural abscess. I've seen it before. Clinical, in terms of organisms causing spinal epidural abscess, these are introduced by hematogenous seeding, and sometimes it can happen directly from vertebral osteomyelitis or discitis, and or spinal surgical procedures as well. Risk factors, again, people who inject drugs. I see it over. In fact, that is usually how I'm able to get them to admit that they inject drugs, is because we find somebody comes in, they've got a bacteremia, I get called, I look for the source of the bacteremia, I find the pain in the neck, I scan them, I see the epidural abscess, then I go back and ask the patient, are they a drug user? Oftentimes it's no. And then I tell them what they have, and then they will admit to me, and then I help them because I help them not withdraw in the hospital, because that's important for their overall health too. Back pain is the most common complaint, and then fever. It says variable, but I've seen fever pretty significantly as well. Weakness, vertebral pain can be also a presenting symptom as well as spinal and paraspinal tenderness, radicular pain, and then any sort of spinal cord compression, including weakness, bladder, bowel dysfunction, sensory changes, paralysis, catecholaminoid. So the abrupt loss of motor function can be due to a cord ischemia or infectious vasculitis or thrombosis. The location is most commonly happening in the thoracic. Please, when you're scanning, go up and down. So go a couple levels up and go a couple levels below, as there may be somewhat referred pain as well. You can get extension into paravertebral tissue, such as the iliopsoas. I can't tell you, when you look for iliopsoas abscesses, they are there, right? So whenever I find a paraspinal abscess, I'll often look for something on the psoas, and we'll typically find it as well. So, of course, you want to check your regular labs, including your markers of inflammation, because those are nice to follow, along with a white count. LPs are somewhat contraindicated if you do suspect an abscess, but when done, boy, do you see white counts. Holy smokes, right? Like, huge white counts, right? Obviously, for obvious reason, in the Gram stain and the cultures come back positive almost right away. Don't confuse it with other routine types of back pain. That, of course, is easier said than done. I mean, how many people come in with back pain to the doctor's office all the time? So that's kind of hard to figure that one out. Guillain-Barré and other etiologies as well. Radicular pain can also mimic and cause misdirection, so something to consider, and then also can sometimes be confused with zoster. Suspect in patients complaining of severe back pain and findings of fevers, chills, leukocytosis, this sort of stuff. Typically, again, when an ID doctor comes in, the blood cultures have been positive, and so I go in there and try to find the blood cultures. Of course, people come in, especially our our drug users who come in seeking as well. It's kind of hard to tease out where that, if that pain is real, is it not? You know, we've all had that difficulty inside the hospital. But if you do see fevers and chills, especially if you see white counts, especially if you see bacteremias, definitely bring ID on early or scan them yourselves. And if you look for it, you will definitely find it. MRI is the best way to go about doing it as well. Probably the most important thing in terms of boards is that this is, and I guess I'm still on diagnosis, but I'm going to jump to that, and then I'm going to come back to diagnosis, is that this is mostly a surgical. So you need to bring your surgeons on early as well as antibiotics. Antibiotics are not going to cure it by itself. So still sticking with the diagnosis portion, however, though, is obviously CT-guided aspiration, if possible. And if you're thinking in terms of TB, of course, you can do either your PPD or your IGRAs. And, of course, your culture data is almost, I've never seen it not positive, even in the face of antibiotics. These will grow very, very rapidly, especially for Staph aureus as well. And, again, you need to bring your surgeons in early on this, okay, because, like it says there in the middle, epidural abscesses most commonly require both surgical and medical therapy. So it's important, and that's what, if I were to write a test question, I would write something along those lines, to get you guys to know that this is something that you need to bring surgeons in. Oftentimes these are small and they say we want to operate. That's great. You know, now we have their opinion. Oftentimes they're quite large that they actually need to go in there and drain them. Medications, of course, are going to be vancomycin is what you're going to be utilizing, and or some of the cephalosporins there that cover pseudomonal coverage, and which is why those two are selected, particularly ceftazidine and cefepime as well. Surgery and drainage. Progressive neurological signs or clinical deterioration should prompt consideration of emergency and neurosurgical decompression. Again, if I were to write a board question, I would write something along the lines that helps you guys recognize that surgery and early surgical intervention is important, as well as vancomycin to cover for the Staph aureus. And I would have you guys know that what you're mostly seeing is happening mostly in our population of people who inject drugs. We are in an unprecedented opioid epidemic that I'm sure each one of you are familiar with. And as more practices are like mine, in which we're not writing scheduled medications anymore, people are shifting their opioids over to injection. And so we're seeing an unprecedented injection drug user epidemic happening now. And we're going to start seeing more cases of endocarditis, and we're going to start seeing more cases of these epidural abscesses. So the reason why I included this on this section of the board review is so that you guys are aware of it. We are in this unprecedented opioid epidemic, and you will see epidural abscesses.